Welcome to the Cold Steel Podcast, hosted by Amir Farouk and myself, Chad Ball. We consider it an absolute privilege to bring you guests from around the world who are truly experts in their craft. Our mission is to offer you a combination of not only masterclasses on clinical surgery topics, but also insights into achieving personal growth, productivity, and fulfillment as both a surgeon and perhaps more importantly, as a human.
This week, we had the pleasure of interviewing Dr. Peter Brennan. Dr. Brennan is an oral maxillofacial surgeon in Portsmouth, England. A tremendously accomplished academic, Dr. Brennan has a keen interest in human factors in surgery. In addition, he is the co-editor of the Gray's Surgical Anatomy textbook. We highly recommend checking out the textbook, as well as the links to Dr. Brennan's prolific work on human factors in surgery. And as always, those links are in the show notes.
Could you tell us where you grew up and what your training pathway looked like?
Yeah, thanks very much, Chad. And please call me Peter. You know, we talk about lowering gradients. We might talk about that a little bit later. So it's Peter, please. I was born in the south east of England and spent 18 years there, and then I went to dental school first and then to medical school in London, and subsequently did my surgical rotation up in Cambridge, which was a lovely city, and then came down to the south coast and did my specialty training for 5 or 6 years, and stayed here ever since, really. So it's a lovely part of the UK. It's lots of sun. We see lots of skin cancer down here. Lovely part of the world.
So the real question is, what football team do you support?
Oh, I'm not going to answer that, because whatever I say is going to be wrong to some of your listeners. So I'm going to keep silent on that one.
That's fair.
But wise choice. I think. Several. There's some fantastic teams, isn't there, really? And they kind of do the rounds, don't they? So go in and out of favor and things. But I'm going to keep quiet on it.
Smart, wise decision. Well, we really wanted to talk to you about a lot of the work that you've done around human factors. I mean, you've done so much work in a variety of different things, but it seems like human factors in the surgical environment have really become a passion of yours.
Yeah.
And you recently did a PhD, which is kind of amazing to think about as someone who's, well into their career to go back and do that. So clearly this is like a passion of yours. So can you talk to us about what are human factors exactly?
Yeah. So I guess the clue's probably in the name, isn't it, really? Human. So, as humans, we make lots of errors on a kind of daily basis. So I think for me, human factors is, yes, it's a science, but it's also applying common sense when we come to work, and it's looking at the factors that affect our individual performance. It's looking at the factors that affect our relationship and the way we work within teams, because of course in surgery we all work as part of a team. So it's effective communication, it's lowering hierarchy, it's situational awareness, it's all of those factors really coming into play. And I suppose finally the ergonomics side of things, so how we interact with equipment and things that we use in medical technology.
It's funny, it's almost like you're describing everything outside, everything that really matters that's generally not found in a textbook.
Yeah. So it's, a lot of what I've said, I mean, you mentioned about my PhD, and thanks for that. It's 275 pages long. And actually, the theme flowing through most of it is actually common sense application. And, the number of times when we come to work, or we're in the operating room and we work for 7 or 8 hours nonstop, and we don't stop to take a break. We wouldn't do that, in normal day life. I mean, you wouldn't drive from Vancouver to Calgary nonstop, would you? You would stop at a number of points and have a comfort break, have something to eat and drink. But historically, surgeons have worked for 7, 8, 9, 10 hours nonstop, and that's not physiologically correct. Plus, the effect it has on the morale of the team, tiredness, fatigue, all those things come into play. So really important.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And we're obsessed on the podcast about kind of thinking about
all the sort of non-technical side of surgery and how to optimize that and become better surgeons. You know, in your PhD, which I definitely had the pleasure of reading, you kind of talk initially about the four domains of human factors analysis, and you kind of go back to these human factors, these four domains, again and again in a number of your work and in a number of your papers. What are those four domains, and how do they pertain to the operating room?
That's an interesting question. So I'm sure most of you have heard about the Swiss cheese model of error. So that's, I think it's one of the Swiss cheeses, I think it's called Emmental, that's got holes in the cheese. And if you imagine slices of those cheese cut and put on a skewer, and they're slowly rotating round. And every now and again, all of those holes are going to line up. And that's when you're going to get an error. And I mean, for me, most error actually doesn't, it's not the fault of one particular person. It's a whole string of things that align together like those holes in the cheese to cause the error. So those four factors you mentioned, the first one is organizational influences. So when we go to work, pressures put upon us by our hospital, putting an extra patient onto the operating list by the management, for example, putting a bit of pressure or stress on us. That's the first layer. You've then got so-called unsafe supervision, and that is a whole host of things, including not supervising the rest of the team, and that's not just your trainees or your more junior doctors. That's other members of the team. That's the nursing staff, the anesthesiologists, how you work together. Not engaging with checklists, for example. That's another example of unsafe supervision. And then you've got the area, so-called preconditions to unsafe act. And that's the area where I've spent the last 7 or 8 years focusing on. And they're the human factors that you can actually actively address and actually block that hole in the Swiss cheese. So they're sort of individual factors, looking after ourselves, optimizing our performance, hydration, eating, tiredness and fatigue, those type of things. And then the team factors that we started talking about, you know, situational awareness, effective communication, better briefing. And then finally, the fourth layer is of course the error itself. So you operate on the wrong side, or you cut a bile duct or whatever it is. That's the final line in the cheese. But so many of these errors are actually preventable.
Although a lot of people have talked about the airline industry and some of the disasters and the cockpit culture and hierarchy that tends to exist. It's probably in North America, Malcolm Gladwell really brought that to the most folks initially. You've also talked a lot about comparisons, both positive and negative, granular and not, between the airline industry and the surgical industry, so to speak. I was wondering if you could frame that for our audience and give us some of your thoughts about those topics.
Yeah, of course. I think it's one simple sentence. You cannot compare aviation and medicine or surgery, period, full stop. What you can do is you can take lessons and human factors that are used and practiced by aviation, by the nuclear industry, by rail, by air traffic services, and you can apply those into the operating room. And that's what I do. So I never compare aviation to surgery at all. But actually, you know, things like effective communication, you know, and the way the pilots actually communicate with air traffic in a very clear way, it's unambiguous. There's no margin of error. In terms of hierarchy, you know, in terms of taking those breaks, all the things I talk about, but I'm never comparing directly aviation with healthcare.
I think that's a very fair kind of way of framing it, in that you're not trying to say that they're the same, but that we definitely can learn things, just like we can learn things from athletes or the military or any number of different organizations. I do want to zero in on something that you've talked about in your PhD, as well as in other things that you've written about kind of flattening the hierarchy. And you know, Dr. Ball mentioned Malcolm Gladwell, and Malcolm Gladwell has this, you know, sort of amazing description in one of his books where he talks about how the Korean Airlines improved their safety outcomes when they actually asked their airline pilots to speak to each other in English in the cockpit. And that effectively kind of reset some of the cultural norms around hierarchy and who could speak to whom and who could challenge whom. And so, you know, it certainly lends credence to this idea that it's really a powerful thing to try and flatten the hierarchy in terms of safety. But is that really possible in an operating room? Like, you know, what does that even look like? You know, I can see this scenario where a medical student comes in, you know, fresh on their clerkship rotation. Yep. They're fresh on their ward. They come into Dr. Balzawar. He's doing a Whipple. And they say, well, should you really be doing that? You know, So how do you kind of, is it really realistic to even think about having a flat hierarchy in the operating room?
Good question. So first and foremost, there has to be a hierarchy, full stop. You know, there has to be an overall attending, a consultant, as they're called in the UK, who is ultimately responsible for that patient. But, you know, the difficulty is actually setting it so the hierarchy is sufficiently shallow so you're not then on a pedestal that no one feels that they're able to actively challenge you. So we would advocate, and we've published on this, and there's a nice, easy to read short article in the British Medical Journal published a couple of years ago about empowering junior doctors to speak up. So I think first and foremost, what you as the team leader need to do is when you have your briefing, introduce everyone. You can call yourself by your first name, by Dr. Ball. It doesn't matter, as long as you say to the team, look, if there's anything you're not happy about, if you want me to clarify, if there's anything you're not sure, please just speak up. And you do that in a nice, warm, open way, rather than with your arms folded. You know, 90% of communication is non-verbal. And the key is actually to do this without fear of retribution. So if that medical student has a point, or they want to say something, actually, I thought it wasn't a Whipple's today, it was something else. Then, you know, if of course it was a Whipple's, you can say, well, yes, actually, the next patient's this or that. So, but you're then not shouting at that that trainee or medical student. You're not angry with them. You're giving them a nice, calm response. So they walk away not feeling anxious that they've said something silly. And of course, they may have said something that isn't particularly relevant, but you know, you've actually gone away and they've given them that experience that they can speak up. And to be perfectly honest with you, most people don't need to speak up because you're flying the aeroplane, you're the attending, you're in charge, you know what you're doing. It's just that rare situation when something just doesn't seem quite right for the rest of the team. And if the team can speak up without fear, they will then do so. And they're your eyes and ears as far as I'm concerned.
You know, I love the way that you frame that environment. I think we can all see it listening to you. We can visualize it. Would you agree that a lot of that really is sort of creating that environment? I mean, it is incumbent upon whoever the quote unquote leader is in that room or in that environment, you know, knowing the first names of everybody, having them maybe call you by the first name in a culture like Canada, you know, interacting with the medical student, talking about their weekend, just sort of creating those relationships and that environment that welcomes a commentary or questions or concerns as the day goes on is an art in itself, probably.
Absolutely correct. But and some people will feel uncomfortable either calling a senior colleague by their first name, or the colleague doesn't want to be called by the first name, and that's absolutely fine. But what's important is that you've lowered that gradient to a point where someone can feel able to speak up if they need to. And of course, bear in mind that in aviation there were a number of fatal air crashes going back to the 60s and 70s and even the 80s, where you know, there was a steep hierarchy, and the first officer felt unable to challenge. So this isn't going to happen overnight. You know, it's an evolving thing that's going to take many years to filter right through healthcare around the world. It's not an instant fix, but all of us need to be doing our part. And as it is in the UK, it's spreading exponentially. People are coming back and saying, you know what, you know, we did the briefing, we've empowered the team. The team feels so much happier now. You know, I'm getting staff wanting to come and work in my theatre rather than wanting to go and work in Dr. Jones's theatre, for example. You know, so it's all about empowerment. It's about happy teams, morale, and all the other things we talk about as well, Chad.
You know, you mentioned right at the top that a lot of the things that you talk about in human factors is almost common sense, right? Like, you know, if you're doing something for a long period of time, it's nice to have sleep, and it's nice to have adequate nutrition and all these kinds of things. But, you know, I wonder again if that is actually achievable for most people in most settings. You know, I think about the days when I was a junior resident responsible for 80 plus patients in the hospital overnight, running around trying to get to the OR, trying to see patients in the emergency department, trying to stop doctor, you know, oh sorry, that never happens, but you know, Whipple patients from getting sick. You know, and then for someone to suggest that, you know, I should get more sleep or I should be able to, you know, get more nutrition, it almost would feel defeating to me. So I'm wondering practically, what does that look like? And I know, you know, from following you on Twitter that you actually will take breaks during a long OR. So can you talk about, like, what does it practically look like to get better nutrition, better sleep, pay attention to those types of human factors?
Okay. Let me just give you a couple of things to think about then. So if you're awake for more than 18 hours, your cognitive function is the same as being about two to three times over the UK alcohol limit, and I guess that's a similar limit in Canada. And of course this creeps up on you slowly, so you don't even realize it's happening. And people then say, well, you know, yes, I can perform at the same standard. And of course, it's happening really slowly, so you don't even know it's happening. If you take hydration, for example, so if you lose 1 to 3 kilograms in body weight through perspiration because you're operating for 7-8 hours, your cognitive function falls by 20%. Again, this happens really slowly. You're not even aware it's happening, but your cognitive function falls by 20%. And there's lots of published papers around that, both from the military and from others. So we've actually looked at taking breaks, maybe every 3 to 4 hours. And, you know, it doesn't need to be a long break, maybe 15, 20 minutes, if it's safe to do so, if you're a point in the surgery where you can stop, you know, walk away, go and have a comfort break, have a drink, something to eat, little chat, take your mind off things. And then when you go back in there, you've optimized your performance, and you'll actually speed up and you'll actually catch that time up in the majority of cases. So, you know, lots of colleagues have now been trying this, and they come back and say, well, you know what, that was a 7-8 hour procedure and I took 50 minute breaks and I've done it in 6.5 hours. And it's like, well, yes, because it's basic common sense. You know, you wouldn't drive for 7 or 8 hours nonstop. You would stop and take a break. So we leave common sense at the front door of the hospital on many occasions when we go to work. And I was exactly the same. I used to operate for 8-9 hours nonstop until my eyes were opened to human factors some years ago. And having made the switch, I'd never go back. And all of the team that we work with, you know, they all now look forward to working with us because they know that, you know, if it's a 9-hour operation, you know, we might take 1 or even 2 rest breaks and catch up, hydrate, have something to eat, and go back and carry on. It makes a massive difference.
Well, you're giving us such great concepts to really contemplate and hopefully engage in our surgical practices. I'm curious though, with these concepts, in particular sleep deprivation, yes, or sleep, yes, hygiene. And we've talked about that on the podcast with a couple of different wellness type folks as well. How do you account for or frame, you know, just genetic variability, you know, sleep gene, no sleep gene, And just the ability of some hyper performers to work incredibly long hours. And I don't necessarily mean, you know, a 2 hour case compared to an 8 hour case, but just maybe even a day and a half of call here, you know, just in these sort of older school structures, because we all clearly see that in our colleagues, folks that really seem to do it with sort of elegance and grace, and other folks that really struggle.
Yeah. And I'm very much in that latter camp. You know, if I don't get adequate sleep, I'm irritable the following day. I'm tired, and I look at those people with some envy, if I'm honest with you. But you know, there is a genetic variability, I think the same principles will still apply, that their performance will slowly be sliding. You know, you cannot maintain that 100% performance for 24, 36 hours. It is impossible, despite what they might say or what you might seemingly think. You know, they are slowly deteriorating. And we would even say, you know, if you're doing a long shift, for example, and yes, it is, or it can be very, very difficult to actually take a little bit of a break. But, you know, if it's, you know, you need to put that oxygen mask on and look after yourself, you know, as they say on the flights, put your own mask on before helping others. You need to look after yourself. So we often say, well, give the bleep maybe to the sister on the ward, if that's possible. Go off and just take a 20-minute cat nap, 15-20 minutes, you know, that can make a massive difference. And I guess there's a difference as well between tiredness and fatigue. So tiredness is is an acute phase, really. So, you know, you haven't had a night's sleep, that's tired. Fatigue is cumulative, and I guess that's something we're all beginning to feel now with the pandemic. You know, it just creeps up on us. That's a much longer term effect, of course.
I was hoping we could switch gears for the last part of it here. We're respectful of your time and talk about, you know, the editorship of Great Surgical Anatomy. I'm curious how you got involved with that textbook, and if you could give us some of the historical context of the text, because it is so important.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, thank you so much. I mean, this for me, whenever I think about this book, it puts a shiver down my spine, and it's actually doing that even as I'm speaking now, and I can put hand on heart. That's really honest. I mean, basically, I've done some work with the editor of Gray's Anatomy itself, Professor Susan Standring, and we've actually published various anatomical variants that we found during surgery and what have you. And I think about 2016, I think it was, I met her at the Royal College of Surgeons, and we were just talking about it. And Gray's Anatomy itself is the most amazing reference book. It's you know, it's an enormous textbook, as you know, but it's not really a surgical book. You can pick up Gray's, read the whole of Gray's, and you go into the operating room and you wouldn't know how to do an anterior resection, for example. So we had this concept of actually bringing it back to Henry Gray's original book, which was 1858. And in fact, the book's called Anatomy Descriptive and Surgical, and it's very much a surgical anatomy text. And as I've said, over the years, Gray's itself has moved away from that and become a reference text of anatomy. So we contacted the publishers. They were really, really keen to get involved. We had to write a detailed proposal. And so we did all that. That then got approved, and then we invited a Canadian surgeon who actually works in Vancouver called Sam Wiseman, who I think had contacted the publishers independently and said, "Oh, there's a need for this book." So the book had been approved, and we brought him in. And then just a question of course, having a name like Gray Surgical Anatomy. You know, we invited world-class surgeons all over. And of course, as soon as you send them an email and you say about the history and it will bring Henry Gray's book to the 21st century, people were absolutely delighted. And we involved a lot of residents, a lot of trainees. I think that's so important. That's empowering them, you know, making sure that the level is set correctly. So a huge amount of undertaking. I think there were something like 10,000 emails that were sent in the last year or so between us. And I was really insistent that we have an opening chapter about human factors. So before you pick up that knife, you have to understand how error happens and ways to reduce medical error in the OR. And then the most surreal moment, Chad, was I was at the Edinburgh College of Surgeons giving a talk about human factors, funnily enough, in November 2019. And I had the proof copy of the Gray's Surgical Anatomy. All the proofs were done online with PDFs and what have you, but they produced me a single PDF, sorry, a single hard copy of the book. And in the college library, there's an original proof edition of the 1858 book by Henry Gray, where he's made numerous corrections in pencil and pen. And to actually hold those two books together was, I think, probably the most surreal moment of my life. And to actually open the page on, in fact, we opened it on one of the head and neck pages, and there was the infratemporal fossa, and to see the drawing that had been done by Henry Carter, and an operative surgical picture of a live operation that was there, and it looked almost identical. It was like, wow, we've just made 150 years of history here, and it's an immense honor. Honor and privilege to help contribute and help the future generation of surgeons. It's honestly, it's a real surreal experience, and I can't wait to do the next edition, really.
Oh, that's an amazing story. You know, it's the conceptual framework with which Gray's and you have styled the delivery and the communication of that information is interesting. Can you talk about that a little bit to the audience, and maybe why it's structured a little bit more different than traditional and anatomical books?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So when you look at Gray's original book, as I said, it's called Descriptive and Surgery. He talked about the surgical anatomy. So, you know, you can cut along this particular muscle and you're absolutely safe, and you sort of veer off of it, and then you're going to hit a major artery, or you're going to cut a nerve. And so that for me was the kind of lesson, if you like. It's like, we want to produce a book that you can actually read, almost like a roadmap. You can actually read that. Yes, you can learn the anatomy as you go along, but it will give you the tools and the knowledge to safely operate. And so we've used operative pictures throughout the book, as you know. That's complemented in certain situations with cadaveric material such as the brain, when you can't have the whole brain exposed, or the brain cut in sagittal section and so forth. And there's also quite a lot of online videos as well. So I think there's about 60 or 70 online videos, both of surgical procedures and cadaveric dissection, again with surgeons talking the reader and the observer through the relevant anatomy so they can safely perform the operation. And we've also included anatomical variants and things that you would see during surgery. And then there's multiple choice questions as well to enable you to kind of think about that afterwards, and have you learnt the chapter. So, I mean, there's lots of bits missing. We could have written a book three times the size, I guess, but it was written based on the curriculum in the UK and the US and Canada for surgical practice. So, you know, for example, it doesn't include a huge amount of obstetrics, of gynecology, of eye surgery, for example. You know, it's very much a book for surgeons that would be sitting their surgical exams. But yeah, I can't wait to do the second edition and expand upon it as well if we can. Hopefully the publishers will give us a bit more space to include a lot more stuff.
Well, I have no doubt they will. It's a beautiful book, and I'd encourage all of our listeners to buy it, because it's truly phenomenal. And to your point, maybe it makes me a little odd, but it's the anatomical variants that I always find the most interesting, whether I operate in that region or not. They're fantastic. The last question, yeah, no, it's beautiful. The last question I wanted to ask you specifically, though, and I can't comment obviously on the UK side of this because I would certainly be ignorant, but in Canada in particular, and the US to some degree, there's been a sustained and considerable de-emphasis on anatomical teaching within medical schools. And then, you know, you can imagine the downstream effects of that anecdotally that we see. You know, students are further behind when they hit residency. Yes. A big portion of their first year especially is just trying to understand anatomy that historically would have been, you know, stone cold clear to them from medical school.
Yes.
And then, you know, also thinking about maybe how that all it also plays into the long-term practice of non-surgeon clinicians as well. I'm curious what it's like in the UK and what your thoughts are on that de-emphasis that we've seen over time here anyway.
Yeah, I mean, if I'm honest with you, I think it's very sad that cadaveric dissection seems to be evaporating away. I think, yes, there are a number of tools that can be used. I mean, you can learn radiological anatomy. You can have 3D models, for example. You can look at videos and online material. But actually not being able to have that hands-on, and it doesn't actually necessarily need to be you doing the dissection, having cadaveric material so you can really appreciate those amazing structures and how they interact. And I can tell you as well with another hat on that I wear is so I used to be a lead for the MRCS, the Member of the Royal College of Surgeons exam in the UK and Ireland. And that's an exam, it's an entry exam to higher training. So residents will take that at about 3 or 4 years after medical qualification. And then they enter specialty training in, you know, general surgery or plastic surgery or what have you. And so we've actually now, we've got a huge amount of research published around that exam. And we have another paper about to be published very, very soon about medical school. And that predicts performance in the MRCS surgery exam. And there's a large anatomy component in that MRCS surgery exam, you know, basic sciences. And it seems that the students who go to the more modern medical schools where there isn't any cadaveric material, they're not performing as well in that exam as those students who have been to the traditional medical schools. So I think you know, cadaveric exposure is really, really important. And I think exposure, no matter what you end up doing, you know, as a physician, as a neurologist, you know, having some understanding of anatomy is really critical. I mean, we had to learn, a medical student, I always remember we had to learn the five layers of the foot. And I had this really bad feeling because I'd already qualified in dentistry beforehand. So I had this really bad feeling when I went to the viva, I was going to get asked about the foot. And sure enough, that's exactly what happened. And it's like, tell me about the layers. I'm actually not sure that is actually relevant for every single medical student to learn all of those five layers of the foot, because come on, you know, unless you're going to be a foot and ankle surgeon, do you really need to know that? So, mm-hmm. you know, that, but having a basic understanding of neurology, of the dermatomes, of the where the heart valves are in relation to where you put your stethoscope, where the lobes of the lung are, you know, when you're filling an abdomen, where the you know, the cross section, what's at L1, what's at T12, you know, I think that's really important. And sadly, it seems a lot of that is going away. And in the UK, a lot of medical schools are teaching more about empathy and communication skills and things, and that's really important as well. Don't get me wrong, that's really important, but it seems that anatomy does seem to be reducing perhaps in the undergraduate curriculum. And then of course then you become a surgeon and you're like on a sea without a chart. You know, you haven't learned that anatomy, and so it's a very steep learning curve to try and learn the anatomy for your board exams.
You've been listening to Cold Steel, the official podcast of the Canadian Journal of Surgery. If you like what you've heard, please leave us a review on iTunes. We love to hear your thoughts, comments, and feedback, so send us an email at podcast.cjs@gmail.com or tweet at us @CanJSurge. Thanks again.